Well, very good Monday to you. I'm Eric Dethridge for Craig Blumenschein, who will be back in the driver's seat on Main Street tomorrow. But for today's show, we thought we'd bring you a timely special from the Humankind podcast dedicated to the ideals of democracy. In the second half of the show, you'll hear how America's 18th century founders emphasized the importance of a free press and educated citizenry to the success of their experiment in democracy. But up first, a profile of a man that's near and dear to our hearts in public radio. And with the bad news that you probably heard about last week regarding the elimination of federal dollars for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, we thought it might be a nice time to go back to our roots. Here is the inspiring story of one of public radio's founders. David Freudberg is the host of this Humankind special, Public Radio in Democracy.
Humankind is produced in association with WGBH Boston and supported by the Humankind Program Fund. Additional funding for this series has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Institutes of Health, the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and the Park Foundation.
It's extraordinarily affirming for people to have a voice. It's part of their participation in community development. It's part of their ability to have a stake in what happens to their lives.
A founding father of our public radio system spreads the vision of community-based broadcasting overseas. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Although many public radio listeners may be unfamiliar with his name, they continuously hear the imprint of Bill Siemering, one of the guiding lights of public radio in America, the original program director of National Public Radio and the author of its lofty mission statement. Bill Siemering envisioned taking the microphone out of what he called the sterile studio and into the places where real people live and work. He fostered artistic creativity in using the rich medium of sound to tell stories. And most of all, in his soft-spoken Midwestern style, he advocated a broadcast system that would show common decency, a basic respect for individuals that could bring people together.
One of the great values of radio is its ability to bridge. You can bond with people who are similar. But then you can also bridge by going to different neighborhoods, going to places that you wouldn't ordinarily go. And that's what I believe that public radio could do.
Bill Siemering and his colleagues at NPR developed a new sensibility and a new sound for radio. It was put to the test on the very first broadcast of All Things Considered from Washington on May 3, 1971, a tumultuous day when anti-war protesters converged on the Capitol.
Rather than pulling in reports from all over town, we thought we might try to take you to the event, to get the feel, the texture of the sort of day it's been.
A handful of police officers has succeeded in clearing at least half of this roadway. Traffic is flowing again.
Now, how did you get here?
I came by boat on the Potomac River.
Is this your boat?
Yes. It's a one-man kayak.
Hearing from ordinary citizens, not just officials, was part of the idea. In the NPR mission and goals statement, Bill wrote that public radio will promote personal growth rather than corporate gains. It will regard individual differences with respect and joy rather than derision and hate, and result in a service to listeners which makes them more responsive, informed human beings and intelligent citizens.
1970 was when we were talking about it and writing that mission. And it was historically a time when there was a lot of division racially. There were few, if any, African Americans who were on television news or as journalists in print newspapers or on radio. most of the information came with the white male voice of authority from New York or Washington telling us this is the way it is. And we didn't hear from real people. We didn't hear from people that were affected by the news. And it was kind of an unnatural, artificial sound. So we wanted to also have a variety of perspectives on things, that there wasn't a single truth, perhaps. People are operating their lives, they're behaving in ways based upon their perception of reality. And it may be very different, one from another. And it was really important to hear that, hear those differences. And it was important to hear people that had been marginalized, that were minorities, who were only seen in the news when there was crime stories and things of that nature. So those were some of the things that we incorporated. So I said in the mission statement that it would speak with many voices and many dialects, that it would reflect the pluralism that is America.
I know that giving people access, giving them a voice has been so important to you. How does giving people a voice make a difference?
It's very empowering. And they don't feel shut out. They feel that they are able to participate, that their views are heard by somebody. I've seen this overseas in my work, in wherever I've gone, in developing countries in South Africa, Mozambique, Mongolia, Eastern Europe.
Because radios are portable, inexpensive, and can be operated without an electrical outlet, radio broadcasting is the dominant medium in many parts of the globe. But due to economics and government control, radio programming in many lands has been one-dimensional, presenting state-run newscasts and homogenized selections of music. In extreme cases, radio has been used by governments to stir up ethnic hatreds and violence. But an opening occurred for more community service-oriented broadcasting in the 1990s, following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the demise of apartheid segregation in South Africa. Allowing local culture to be heard and enjoyed, as on this broadcast from a community-run station in South Africa, was a way Bill Siemering hoped to enhance citizen involvement in South Africa's newly egalitarian society. He was hired by a private foundation, the Open Society Institute, to promote grassroots radio around the world. Lessons learned while pioneering public radio in the United States could now be shared overseas. And he found receptivity at the broadcasting authority of South Africa's new government.
The first priority they gave was to community radio, because they felt that would serve the interests of the new democracy best. And they gave no licenses the first year to for-profit radio, which I thought was interesting. I went there first in 1993 to meet with a group of people that were interested in community radio as an idea, and also interested in transforming the state broadcasting, South African Broadcasting Corporation, into one that more clearly reflected the diversity of the country. So it was the idea, part of it was the slogan of giving a voice to the voiceless, that, you know, in the townships they never had a voice of their own, and here was a chance for them to create their own community radio station. So there was a little adjustment there in the beginning when some people had said, well, everyone has a right to be on the radio. I said, well, I think everyone has a right to expect something worth listening to on the radio. Not everyone has something worthwhile to say. So you don't just put a microphone in the market and just let people come up and say whatever they want. Because the listeners also were very responsive initially, and they said, gee, that host isn't very good. And so they quickly realized that the quality of the programming had to be good.
The economic crisis in Zimbabwe has brought with it untold suffering and misery among the ordinary people of that country.
Community radio can serve a wide variety of functions, to provide news and dialogue on important issues, to offer music and other culture, and if genuinely rooted in local participation, the station itself can become a forum for directly addressing serious problems. Bill Siemering.
There was a vicious, violent dispute between different taxi drivers and in this one township. And so they brought the taxi drivers in to the station and said, you know, all right, community, what do you want them to do? How do you want them to run their business here? And so they resolved the conflict there. There was a potential school strike that the station got wind of, and again, they used their impartiality to mediate the dispute. When I asked the manager what he felt was his greatest success, he said resolving the school strike before it happened. In Kosovo, a very different place, there was a station that called Radio Plus, and it's in Pristina. They tell the listeners that they're really an important part of their programming. They rely on them a lot, and they have a number of call-in programs. And during one of the call-in programs, a listener said, you know, there are 30 orphans in the hospital that no one is caring about at all. And so right on the spot, they formed a committee to help them. And they raised money, they brought in clothes and toys and what have you. And so when I asked him what his greatest success was, he said, my greatest success was when the doctor from the hospital called and said, tell your listeners, we have enough. The orphans are taken care of. And you see, they were using it to create community in that sense. They had a support group for families whose husbands were being held in prison in Serbia. So that was another kind of using radio in that creative way. In Sierra Leone, there's a very entrepreneurial and extraordinary man named Andrew Croma, who has a couple of stations, one in a provincial capital called Bo, which I visited. And he provided voter education for the last election. And there was a greater turnout in his listening area than any other part of the country. In addition, he has an investigative program called Mr. Owl. And Mr. Owl exposes corruption of various kinds, where a government worker is using his official vehicle for a taxi, or where in one case a policeman was helping a illegal diamond merchant get through the border crossings to smuggle diamonds away. And they will broadcast some of these things as they're happening. There were a number of abuses of the police where they would perhaps take a woman prisoner out and use her as a prostitute and keep the money. As a result of calling these abuses to public attention, the police department created a community affairs unit. And there were other authorities realized that the police needed more money because they were doing this kind of stuff because they weren't getting paid enough. So here again is a station that is actively engaged in improving the community. With Andrew Croma in Sierra Leone, he actually exposed some problems with the electric company that had been bartering with him for airtime. So he would put on advertisements for the electric company and service announcements and get the service for nothing or a reduced rate. So when he exposed some wrongdoing of the electric company, they said, you owe us $2,500. Fortunately, he happened to be in America and was on the public radio program Fresh Air and talked about this. And a listener heard this and said, I'll help him, and gave that money necessary for him to pay that electric bill.
It's nice when it comes full circle like mm-hmm. that.
There are wonderful examples where soap operas are used to convey social information. And the Search for Common Ground, that is a U.S.-based organization, has studios in Burundi, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, where they've had things on health and peace. So, for example, in Sierra Leone, it was through these programs that they went out and talked to the rebels. The government radio would never talk to the rebels. They would say they shouldn't be heard on the radio. But in order to have some peace, they felt it was necessary to do that. They would have youngsters that had been in the rebel camps who had escaped talk directly to their former captors and say, come in, it's safe to come in now. Tell their friends, you know, I'm here, you can come back. So that kind of direct appeal worked very well.
So it was kind of a safe way to deliver the message.
Yes, and there was peace then. I mean, there has been peace. And
did people come back?
Some did, yes. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of trying to resolve conflict, how do we do this? I visited their studio in Burundi, where they had Hutus and Tutsis working together, creating programs.
These, of course, were the warring factions that gave rise to the terrible massacres.
Genocide in Rwanda, in nearby Rwanda, yes. And the stations in Burundi were created as a result in a reaction against the hate radio in Rwanda, where they actually told people to go out and kill. It was, I think, the only time that I know of where radio was used for that, for genocide, really, in such a horrific way. So in Burundi, they said, we want radio that will be for peace and reconciliation. And so in spite of the fact that the Hutus and Tutsis had been at war with each other and were still having battles in the countryside, on the radio, you could hear them covering the same story, reporting it together. They would send out a Hutu and Tutsi together, and they would both come back to tell the story. And there were radio dramas that showed, again, how Hutus and Tutsis can work together in ways that they might not be on the ground doing this quite yet, but how to resolve differences that they had. And there's a women's program where the women were actually preparing gardens and homes for returning refugees. Again, Tutsis and Hutus working together. The women were working together while their husbands were off someplace else fighting each other yet. So the radio was a catalyst to help create about 400 women's groups around the countryside where they could where they could work together.
Thousands of miles away, a man pulls water out of a deep well in the mountains of Mongolia's Gobi Desert region. Mongolia is a landlocked northern Asian country bordered by China and Russia. Long under Soviet rule, it has now emerged as an independent nation with free elections and a budding system of community radio stations. Among the world's oldest countries, Mongolia is one of Bill Siemering's favorites, owing to its hardy people and magnificent, unspoiled scenery.
We started working in the countryside, in the small provincial capitals, so I did a workshop on how you start a station, and I talked about South Africa, and at first, people kind of looked at askance, saying, Africa? What can we learn from Africa? And after they heard the story about how it worked there, they said, yeah, we can relate to that. We've been marginalized. We don't have a voice of our own. We don't have many resources. So now there are perhaps a dozen local stations there, not all supported by the foundation, but the foundation gave them money for equipment and 3 months operating costs, and then they're on their own. And some of those stations are operating on $1,000 or $2,000 a year. I mean, it's remarkable.
When the Open Society Institute began supporting fledgling community radio stations in Mongolia, it faced a reality. The tradition of free expression and freedom of the press, at least as we know it in the West, is a new experience for the people of Mongolia, where democracy has just arrived.
So what are the greatest challenges for these new broadcasters?
Well, they're operating in situations that are frequently highly politicized, and they must have sound journalistic principles so they don't get buffeted about or co-opted by special interests, I think. They need to learn about how to be inquisitive in a way. I think a journalist must have a curious mind to pick up stories and to have enough curiosity to see it to the end. When people are used to just kind of the state news, there's not much room for curiosity. There's not a tradition of going out and doing a story in the market.
So did you meet people who were eager to break through into a new way of more open communication?
Yes. They listened very attentively, and they went about doing it their way, which is, of course, as they should. I never tell people what to do. I say, here are some tools that you'll need to run a radio station. Here's how you organize a program schedule. Here are principles of journalism, ethical principles you need to follow to protect yourself. And then they create it themselves. So they, you know, here's the hammer and nails and saw, and now you create your own structure and make it appropriate. And that's what we always try to work with people on, is what is appropriate for Mongolia, for local radio. It's different than South Africa. It's different than Sierra Leone or some other place. But it's yours, and they make it theirs very much. There's a station called Gobi Wave, and they have a program where they ask the listeners, what's the news? And the listeners will call up and say, well, this is what's happening where I am. There's some goats and sheep in my yard, and I hope the owner will come and get them. Or they have another program call in where people ask the station to find out answers from the government about some question. The governor is on the air twice a week with a half-hour live call-in program where he answers questions. So he's accessible. They also have some wonderful inventive programs. They have one called Love's Guide, where if you are kind of a shy person, you call in and describe yourself and the kind of friend you're looking for. There's another one where they call in, and they may be kind of sweet on somebody, but they're too shy to approach that person. So they will, again, write kind of a love letter to this person, and you say, I think she's writing to me. So there's a correspondence that people eavesdrop on. So, for example, there was a man in prison that has taken up a correspondence with his lawyer's daughter. So it's kind of a secretive thing, but it's broadcast.
Does the lawyer tune in?
I think he might have gotten wind of this.
Back when you wrote NPR's mission, you were reacting to what you call the artifice and hype in so much of the commercial media, a trend that doesn't seem to have gone away. And you've said that the challenge is to make people want to hear what they need to know. How do you see that challenge?
I think that remains the challenge. It's the challenge for the producer, and reporter to tell the story in an engaging way, to make it compelling so that people really want to listen to it. It's the same problem that we talked about overseas, where there's incredibly important health information that people need. They need to know how to live with returning rebels who had been terrorizing a community, and now they're coming back. How do you deal with that? Here in the United States, we don't have such extreme kinds of issues to deal with. But nonetheless, we do need to have a sense of community here. And I think some of the public radio stations could do more with local programming to give a sense of community, of connecting, of taking the listener to sections of the city that they don't, that they may just drive by, or maybe not even that, to get beyond stereotypes. I think we still need to do that with people that may be different in some way from ourselves, so that we don't develop these walls or barriers between people. We want to kind of break through that glass that may separate people.
So what's the most effective way, using the medium of radio, of public radio, for breaking down those barriers?
I think the personal storytelling is one way, oral histories, the kind of work that some of the youth radio projects are doing, where young people will take the listener to a neighborhood, to their neighborhood, that isn't the public radio typical neighborhood, and hear what their life is like. Those are very compelling and artistically produced.
The first person account.
Yes. Getting back to what radio is, intimate, personal, imaginative.
For you, what does it mean to listen, to be a listener?
It means to really focus on the individual that's talking. To really be empathetic and put yourself in their position as much as possible. And to listen for, consciously and unconsciously, but to listen for all these subtleties of voice that they are giving you. There's a richness there if we could but hear it closely without our own filters. So we want to kind of remove our preconceptions and listen to the heart of the matter. So we're listening both consciously and unconsciously, perhaps, as we experience music and other things, you know. But it's a matter of paying attention.
Harder and harder to do in this world where we're bombarded by so many stimuli.
It is. For the quiet voice, the thoughtful voice, the considered voice and opinion is harder and harder to find, and more necessary.
Bill Seemering. He will further the effort to spread community radio worldwide with his new organization, Developing Radio Partners, based in Philadelphia. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Steve Colby. Editorial assistance from Thomas Royal. Special thanks to Tish Valva of Chicago Public Radio. Our program is presented by Human Media in association with The Network Incorporated. Program development and support provided by Chart Media.
The executive producer is David Freudberg. Please subscribe to our free weekly podcast. The title is Humankind on Public Radio. You can find it at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcast services, as well as through our website. Again, the podcast title is Humankind on Public Radio. And if you'd like to support our program, please visit humankindpodcast.org, and at the top, click on How You Can Help.
This segment with community radio visionary Bill Siemering is Humankind program number 78.
You can hear more episodes of our series at humankindpodcast.org. That's humankindpodcast.org.
You just heard part one of our special on Main Street today from the Humankind podcast, Public Radio in Democracy. 91-year-old Bill Siemering, still a guiding light and force for public broadcasting in a time where we could use a little uplift. It is so nice to hear his voice today. Craig Blumenschein will be back on Main Street tomorrow. He'll talk to the CEO of the Commonwealth Fund, Dr. Joseph Bettencourt, about innovative ways to improve health care for all. I'm Eric Dethridge. Up next, host David Freudberg looks back at this whole idea of democracy and how education and a free press fits into it all. You're listening to Prairie Public.
They realized that a democracy required a totally new kind of approach to the society and to education. The people would have to rule, and therefore they had to be educated.
How America's founders took pains to promote a free press and good schools. You're listening to a Humankind special, An Informed Republic. I'm David Freudberg. Right from the start of their high-risk 18th century experiment in democracy, the founders of America recognized an essential truth. For their system of self-government to survive, and many doubted whether it would, we the people need to stay informed, said James Madison, who became known as Father of the Constitution. A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. Journalism historian Robert McChesney.
If people don't know what's going on, they can't really participate at all. And governance will become increasingly run by private special interest, by corporate interest, by those who have the money and wherewithal to know what's going on, to buy politicians, to become the politicians themselves in many cases. It's increasingly we're seeing in politics where just billionaires and multimillionaires just run for office and on their own. It will lead to increasing cynicism, inequality, corruption, all the things that are cancerous to self-government.
So the American revolutionaries saw that independent journalism would be needed to monitor the functioning of government and the forces that influence it.
This isn't some sort of crazy academic theory. This is directly out of Jefferson and Madison. They understood that from the beginning. And that's why both of them said having a viable, credible press system is simply indispensable. It's the first order of business for a free society.
I'm in Washington on a sunny afternoon outside the Newseum, a magnificent gallery and interactive exhibit about America's centuries-old tradition of journalism. The facade of this six-floor building displays a large marble tablet. Engraved in it is the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government.
In one hall of the museum, early newspapers are exhibited, one from England the size of a pamphlet dating back to the 1400s. Olivia Blanchard stood gazing into the glass display case.
I think it's amazing that so long ago, people were writing news and looking for the truth.
It's also amazing that they were able to preserve these old papers, that they didn't just crumble over time.
It's the coolest thing to be able to see what people saw back then. It's amazing how detailed the illustrations were.
How important do you think it is for our country to have the ability to express ourselves and for journalism to be able to operate freely?
I think it's so important because without the freedom to know the truth, to tell people what's going on, we don't really know what's happening. And to know what to not know what's happening. Bad things can happen again, and that's never good.
By the way, are you a reader of newspapers or websites?
I do. I read the newspaper in the morning before I go to school.
You do? What grade are you in?
Sixth.
Is that unusual for a sixth grader?
I don't know. I look at the front page, I glance. If something looks interesting, then I'll read more about it.
And do you also look at the news online?
Not so much online. Because my family gets a bunch of newspapers, so it's just easier to look when they're right there. But online, it's helpful if I'm doing a report in school.
There's many other parts of the world that don't have a free press or one that are obviously controlled by the government, and they are much different, much closed societies that don't have anywhere near the freedom of information that we have to make important decisions.
Now, that said, do you think the average American is getting adequate information to perform our duties as citizens?
I think that never before have we had so many different news outlets and channels to choose from, and I think it's up to everybody to not focus in on one single voice, but to do a medley of all of the points of view, because no one of them is correct. Every media has its own specific bias.
I think that some newspapers, and I won't call names, I think they tend to write from a certain angle. And during election time, for me, it's apparent that some papers are supporting certain candidates. So they tend to write in favor of one candidate and against another.
They had to have an educated citizenry, or the whole venture, and they saw it as an adventure, as a challenge, would fail. The experiment would fail.
Brown University historian Gordon Wood is author of Empire of Liberty and winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He's an expert on the early American Republic.
Nothing on this scale, Democratic government or Republican government, had ever been tried since the fall of Rome. So they know they're doing something very new, very tricky, very problematic. Can we make it succeed? That's what, of course, runs right through American history. That's what Lincoln is talking about 70 years later. We have the last best hope. Can we make it? Can democracy make it? That's an issue that they think about, and they have confidence, but they need an educated citizenry.
In the 1770s, the decade of ferment that gave birth to the United States, American colonists became agitated by what they saw as unfair tax policies and trade restrictions, as well as harassment by the British Crown. As the revolutionaries' movement gained momentum, activists in the 13 East Coast colonies strengthened their lines of communication.
Up and down the seaboard, there was an effort through newspapers and pamphlets to engage the citizenry, to inform them about their political rights, and they believed that if the population was well informed about their political rights, then British measures at tyranny would be stymied.
Richard Brown, University of Connecticut historian and author of The Strength of a People.
Their ideology that came out of opposition politics in Britain told them that if a people was ignorant, sleepy, lazy, they were easily manipulated by demagogues and tyrants.
But cultivation of an informed citizenry was viewed by the revolutionaries as more than a political necessity. When America's founders sounded the Liberty Bell at Philadelphia to let freedom ring, they were proclaiming a new view of human rights, even if that view was constrained by 18th century mores. For Virginia's Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence, it was the starting point for an entirely different kind of society.
Well, the vision would be that when human beings are educated, that they live their lives by reason. He was a person who believed that reason should be, as he said, in its seat, and progress would unfold from there.
Historian and law professor Annette Gordon Reed, winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award for her book The Hemingses of Monticello, is a Jefferson scholar.
So this idea of the diffusion of knowledge throughout the citizenry was a way of ensuring that the values of the Enlightenment, of which he would have thought of himself as an Enlightenment progressive type, would spread across the country and would spread across the land. And he almost saw it as an inevitable thing, that if educated people would make the right choices. Now, that was a part of his own sort of personal optimism. And, of course, there were people who felt differently, who had a more, they would say, realistic view of human nature, saying that that's not going to be enough, that, in fact, you have to have an elite or elites in order to make decisions, that they will be the people who will always rule. That was much more of a Hamiltonian a vision, that there would always be an elite who would control. I think Jefferson and others took a more capacious view of what democracy should be, that in fact, the more people who were involved, more people who were educated, more people who were knowledgeable, that it would fuel the general sense of progress in the world, and you wouldn't have to rely upon elites to do that. But I think all of them understood there had to be citizen involvement. With no monarchy, the people had to be sovereign.
Listening to An Informed Republic, a special from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on this segment, please visit our website, humanmedia.org. Today's high-speed printing technology would probably have blown the mind even of the inventive Benjamin Franklin, who operated a hand-cranked press at his print shop in Philadelphia, where Poor Richard's Almanac was published starting in 1732. Early America relied on the printed word as the foremost medium of information, and a high degree of literacy pervaded the United States from its inception. Historian Gordon Wood.
Close to 90% in New England, males, women less, but maybe 70%. But there's probably no place in the world, with the possible exception from what studies have been made, of parts of Scandinavia where you had such high literacy. And of course, by the early decades of the 19th century, we had become the greatest newspaper reading public in the world. I mean, more papers read here than, not per capita, but just in total numbers of newspapers than anywhere else in the world.
Early American readers learned legal, political, and commercial information from their newspapers, frequently published by small-town printers. And once the final state, Rhode Island, ratified the Constitution, America's founders realized that newspapers, often transported by horseback riders, would play a vital role in preservation of the emerging country. Richard Brown.
They understand that they have a vast territory in 1790, that in order to create a nation, there must be a community of citizenship, a community of information. And if there is to be such a community of information, there must be national networks that will enable this community of information to be created and to continue to operate. There was a postal system, of course, operating under the British, and indeed Benjamin Franklin was a postmaster for the American colonies. And it was always seen from the beginning that having a post office was a key function of a national government.
For the purpose of diffusing knowledge, as well as extending the living principles of government to every part of the United States.
Benjamin Rush, physician, Philadelphia Quaker, and signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Every state, city, county, village, and township in the Union should be tied together by means of the post office. This is the true non-electric wire of government. It should be a constant injunction to the postmasters to convey newspapers free of all charge for postage.
They encourage newspaper editors to exchange newspapers freely with each other, and newspapermen could send their newspaper to other newspapers free. So
there's this grand, you might call it an internet of newspapers, moving information freely through the postal system. And the idea was that the newspapers should be a mechanism whereby people should be informed about public affairs, local affairs, state affairs, national affairs, international affairs. They wanted people to not be parochial, located only in their own little community, but to raise their consciousness to a broader appreciation of public affairs.
Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers, or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. Thomas Jefferson.
When you look at the colonial period and how few, relatively few newspapers, relatively few magazines existed, and then look at what happened after 1776, an extraordinary transformation.
Historian Gordon Wood.
Magazines exploded, newspapers exploded, and then lecture series, the whole paraphernalia of civil society emerges. Libraries, public libraries in various towns in particularly in New England. Now, the North remains, really advances rather rapidly. The South remains more static, and by 1820, the South has many fewer newspapers, fewer libraries, fewer of all of these instruments in the South. The South remains much more rural, much more stuck in the 18th century. And so the differences in the two sections begin to emerge, I think, rather quickly.
The founders of the United States were keenly aware that democracy always comes with risks. For the system to work, for voters to make wise choices, the citizenry must make the effort to be knowledgeable. Said American revolutionary Thomas Paine, those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must undergo the fatigue of supporting it.
People can be fooled if you don't know how the government works, if you don't know your own powers as a citizen, what you have a right to demand, what you have a right to expect from your leaders.
Historian and New York Law School professor Annette Gordon Reed.
You have to know how it works. And it's not a terribly complicated process. You know, strangely enough, it's not a wildly, you know, convoluted system we have here. But I think the real thing is that you can't make the government work for you. You can't play your role in the government if you don't understand how these things work. And it's really frightening to think that people don't understand, you know, the rights, the Bill of Rights, don't understand the Constitution, don't understand the procedures that make the government run. And it's all about, that's how you preserve freedom. You have to be knowledgeable in order to do that.
If you think of authoritarian governments, they hold the society together from the top down. But a republic or a democracy has to be held together from the bottom up. And so you need people who are educated, who are willing to support the society, are willing to give up their selfish interests for the sake of the public good, and these people need to be educated.
Jefferson's commitment to education was really at the core of his life.
Charles Haynes, senior scholar at the First Amendment Center in Washington, has studied the American revolutionaries.
They were part of this influence of the Enlightenment that said, you know, learning and education really can lead to progress, lead to truth. And they had a deep commitment to that.
Many of America's founders were interested in great works of philosophy and history and emphasized the teaching of the classics as part of a well-rounded education for citizens.
Greek and Latin, for example, would be at the core of learning. And of course, that really goes back to being able to read the Bible in those early languages. But then it also speaks to their interest in the great classics and reading Plato and Cicero and so forth. They believe those writers, Aristotle, were necessary to really understand virtue and to understand what kinds of human beings we should be. And so classical education. George Washington, of course, helped to found a school in Alexandria, Virginia, the Alexandria Academy. and it encouraged a classical education, and he was very intent that this school be open to everyone and there be free tuition for those who couldn't afford it. Orphans of people who died in the Revolutionary War should be open to them. It should be open to African Americans. It should be open to women. He was way ahead of his time in terms of saying, look, we need to found schools that will educate all levels of society, all people. That will prepare them for citizenship in this republic.
I think every single revolutionary thought about this issue of education, and many of them sat down and wrote up plans for essentially a three-tiered system that's not all that different from what we have today. Jefferson's most famous, where he talked about both boys and girls would go to what we call elementary schools, and then he said we'll rake the rubbish, that's the term he used, and pull out of this elementary school those bright boys only who would go on to grammar school, which would be essentially high school, but teaching Latin in preparation for university. And then the best, and all of this was to be publicly supported, that is with tax money, and then the best of the grammar school graduates would be sent on to the university, which would also be publicly supported for the elite leadership that would result.
And this was Jefferson's bill for the more general diffusion of knowledge,
right,
in Virginia, where he lived,
right,
at Monticello.
Right, right. And of course, others, Benjamin Rush, others drew up. In fact, I think per capita were probably more publications on education in this period than at any time in our history. I mean, it's a real spate of publications. Everybody's talking about education.
Benjamin Franklin, who founded the University of Pennsylvania and the Library Company of Philadelphia, wrote that education of youth is the surest foundation of happiness. Charles Haynes.
He famously said, only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. But less quoted is the second part of that same sentence where he said, as nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters.
Meaning tyrants.
That's right. And he believed that unless we provided education so that people would learn civic virtue and would practice civic virtue, they would be subject to authoritarian and tyrannical impulses.
For many of America's founders, moral development and the practice of courtesy were almost a preoccupation. As a schoolboy, George Washington would write out in elegant script the rules of civility. The revolutionaries envisioned a society based on moral principles. Joel Spring is an historian of education at the City University of New York.
You're sitting there after the revolution, you're scratching your head, trying to figure out how things are going to work. You're worried about the mobs out there. You've just had a revolutionary war where you've had these people come out of the forest to shoot their guns at the British, etc. How are you going to control them? Well, you start preaching civility and morality and we'll all get along, and you try to paint that picture and you try to educate people that way.
Personal and social virtues were an explicit topic taught in early American schools.
In the minds of most educators, and let's say in the early 19th century, these were Protestant virtues. And in fact, when Horace Mann organized the common school in the 1830s, he was concerned about religious conflict over the common school. So what Horace Mann advocated was that what we would do is we would take the basic virtues taught in the King James Version of the Bible, and without any religious trappings, those would be the virtues taught in the school, and those would be the virtues necessary to sustain the republic.
And could you specify some of those virtues?
Responsibility, reciprocation. If you do something good for me, I should try and do something good for you. Charity, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The idea that the rich were blessed by God and the poor had a chance to be rich and therefore virtuous. Hard work, diligence. Idle hands are the devil's tool. So these were the kind of virtues that you had a responsibility to your fellow human beings. Of course, we had slavery, and we won't go into that, and Native Americans, which means that many white people weren't responsible at all. But anyway, to other free people, you were responsible, and within the golden rule, and that at the same time, you worked hard to improve the community itself. And we have to remember that until the Bible and prayer decisions of the 1960s, that most public schools in this country opened with a school prayer and a reading from the Bible. When I went to school in Florida, that's how school began, and those were virtues that were to be instilled.
The United States, founded on Jefferson's declaration that all men are created equal, has continuously struggled to interpret that principle from generation to generation. At the country's beginning, only property-owning white males were allowed to vote. Full citizen participation has advanced only by fits and starts since the Revolution. Historian Annette Gordon Reed.
Hamilton believed that the reason for the condition of African Americans during that time period is because they were not educated and that they had not been given opportunities. There wasn't a what you would call an abolitionist movement in the way we think of it towards the antebellum period.
But you're saying that Alexander Hamilton understood that the black population was disadvantaged because of education?
Yes. I mean, that's one of the things that he said, that the problem is a lack of experience, lack of education, that it's not natural. Now, he was countering at this point some of the things that Jefferson had said in notes in the state of Virginia about black inferiority. He was saying that he ventured it as a suspicion that blacks were intellectually inferior to whites. Hamilton, sort of, and then private correspondence at some point says, well, you know, it really is about the lack of opportunities that people have. How do you say that people are inferior if you've never given them a shot at being educated?
I think the story of American history is the ongoing struggle to live up to the principles and ideals in our Constitution and our founding documents.
Charles Haynes of the First Amendment Center in Washington.
They didn't live up to them. We still have not lived up to them. So the struggle throughout history is to call the American people to go back to those ideals and say, now what can we do to advance freedom and justice for all? How can we come closer to those ideals? So no, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and others, they weren't perfect and they didn't live up to their own ideals.
True of our politicians today.
Well,
it's imperfect.
True, that's right. But you know, I always remember what David Walker, the great abolitionist, African-American abolitionist, said of Jefferson. He said, you know, and this is while Jefferson was still alive, the end of his life, he said, you know, Thomas Jefferson, he's the greatest philosopher alive. He says, but I don't know why he says what he says about black people. But he said, but here's the issue. How can we out-Jefferson Jefferson on the racial question? And so I think that's always the question for every generation. How can we out Madison Madison and out Jefferson Jefferson? So the ideals, the Jeffersonian ideals, the Madisonian ideals, which are so deeply important to who we are as a people, it's always a struggle to live up to what we say we believe.
Listening to Humankind, I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Antonio Oliard. Editorial assistance from Thomas Royal and Kathy Graham. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to Laura Carlo, Guy Byrne, and Tony Buck. Our program is produced by Human Media in association with WGBH Boston. Program development provided by Chart Media.
The executive producer is David Freudberg. Please subscribe to our free weekly podcast. The title is Humankind on Public Radio. You can find it at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcast services, as well as through our website. Again, the podcast title is Humankind on Public Radio. And if you'd like to support our program, please visit humankindpodcast.org. And at the top, click on How You Can Help. You can hear more episodes of our series at humankindpodcast.org. That's humankindpodcast.org.